The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist.
You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. It is March 31st, 2012. And tonight, I've got to get moving here. We are going to pack a whole lot into this hour because what I've decided to do is something that I've only recently put together in one place. I've taken notes, it's been scattered around for many years, and put them together to create, hopefully, a coherent presentation. And that is in the history of the philosophy of Serbia, starting with Vuk Karadzic and ending up with the famous duo of Justin Popovic and Nikolai Vemilovic. And so what we're going to do is hopefully bring all of these people together and make some sense out of them. Vuk Karadzic is one of the most significant of the 19th century philosophers of Serbia. His primary concern is linguistics. He's known as the man who refined and made sense out of different Serbian dialects to create a literary language. And what he did is of immense significance. He takes the folk idiom of the bulk of the people who he studied, and he connected his literary language to their particular idiomatic way of speaking. That he saw the peasantry as the ultimate, really only real source of literature and language. The critical idea here, Karadzic, is that it is the language, it is the peasant idiom more than anything else that creates a real legitimate nation. There is a tightly integrated idea in his linguistic theory between the folk and the common folk language and its connection with a cultural community. The state then could only have legitimacy when it places itself upon that folk understanding. Remember, usually when nationalists talk about language, they're not just referring to words and grammatic structures. They're talking about the content. They're talking about what kind of lifestyle and way of thought inform such a language. So, for him, the only thing that made sense, and this is after Serbia had been under the control of the Ottoman Turks for several hundred years, and now writing about the middle of the 19th century, he is placing the concept of Serbia on a peasant linguistic basis. This is an extremely radical concept that brings both elements of the sort of traditional left and right together into a combination that I personally find very interesting. The core of Serbia is what he's saying here is an agrarian and a decentralized agrarian structure centered around the peasant, centered around the peasant language and the peasant religion. Their heroism as a people and coming under several hundred years of domination by the Turks and Islam is their simplicity and strength becomes the very backbone, the very source of their heroism. The Greek, the Italian influences, as well as the Turkish influences, all of these are very foreign. The Greeks under the Ottoman government, the Italians coming in from the city of Ragusa, all of this is foreign to the Serbian peasant, and the mentality of the imperial Turkish state, which had Greek hangers-on, as well as the city-state of Ragusa and its mercantile way of life. These are not just different languages, but they're different idioms. They're different ways of thought. That even the clergy, while they were very moral and very strong, but their strength in morality comes from their simplicity. And he sees this in Montenegro more than any other place, and much of his linguistic analysis comes from the Montenegrin issue. The real opposite of what it is to be a Serb is oligarchic rule in urban areas. They are parasitic. They are wicked. So the vision of Karadzic, is that Serbdom is essentially a linguistic idea in the broadest sense of the word. The peasantry, the simple folk, is the backbone of the nation. They bled for Serbian independence. They are intensely loyal to the church. And the state, the academic elite, should be following them in terms of way of life, but more importantly here, the way of thought. That words develop as they are used, and they develop and reach a certain meaning given the lifestyle of the peasantry. In Ukraine, we saw this with Drahomanov, who did the exact same thing, going around, searching, listening to the peasant folk songs, copying down what they're saying and how they're saying it, and then from there, build a real literary language and on top of it, a political idea. In Karadzic's work, Serbs All and Everywhere, he's making a linguistic connection from the Orthodox Serbian people, using the language as a way to understand the slow national development. But the problem is, you have some peasants using this language that are Roman Catholic or even Islamic. And so you have a people here speaking the same language that is divided by creed. And so you have class issues, religious issues. And really the only serious criticism of Karadzic that I have is that if he is going to remove Orthodoxy from the center of how the language develops, then he's missing a huge portion of how the actual peasantry thinks. If he's going to say that Serbia is a linguistic concept that comes from the folk, especially the Montenegrins, but then is going to claim that the language is the same amongst the Muslims as it is the Orthodox Serbs, that's a pretty serious contradiction in his thinking. The concept is that since the church is such a huge contributor to the linguistic ideas in the broad sense that we're talking about, those who are Islamic, those who are Roman Catholic, are not in the same idiomatic realm. I mean, he is correct about class, but the fact is, converting to Islam meant that you were a first-class citizen. Remaining Orthodox meant that you were a third-class citizen. And usually the people who converted and became Muslims were those Serbs who were already fairly well off and realized that becoming Islamic was the only way to maintain the property. These are the worst kind of cowards and traitors to the Serbian people. For Karadzic to try to take their contribution to the linguistic struggle, is it makes no sense. But in other works and in other areas, he's more consistent in holding that the church, the peasant life, the extended family, the Druga system, which we've dealt with on this show before, all of this have created a language in the broad sense of the word, and that, precisely that, is the basis of social life and therefore of political theory. Now, I think a little bit more famous than Karadzic is the famous national historian and political theorist Ilya Garashanyan, who dies in 1874, 10 years after Karadzic. Garashanyan is interesting because he is, for the most part, an anti-Russian writer. He sees the Serbs as a peasant nation. A lot of the same rhetoric you see in Serbia as with Ukraine. The peasantry, the folk, becomes the absolute core. And then the cities, often very foreign, in this case it's Greek and sometimes Italian, unlike in the Ukrainian situation where it was very Jewish. Garashanyan sees free trade and the slow development of a modern economy as really at the center of any kind of national rebirth. And he's one of these guys who wants a Yugoslavia. The Yugoslav idea is gaining in popularity in the middle of the 19th century from these people who see a large state as necessary for survival, and a large state also means a larger market. However, Garashanyan says, if there is to be this Yugoslav concept, a strong, large Serbia is necessary as a guarantor not only of Serbian independence, but Yugoslav independence. So Garashanyan's concept is that if Yugoslavia is going to exist, it must be dominated by the Serbs, because the Serbs now are a group of people who are willing to spend out of their own substance to support the independence of groups like the Croats and the Slovenes, who, for whatever reason, were not capable of creating their own independent state structures. In fact, that Serbia had developed their state structures earliest in terms of developing an intellectual core, a diplomatic core. People like Agatashanin were in favor of a Yugoslavia dominated by Serbia, plus the simple fact that the Serbs were disproportionately killed and maimed in the battles against Turkey. There, of course, he says that the Serbs have earned the right to do this. But Gadashanin is a bit more modernist in this sense than Karadzic. He's worried about the concept of democracy in a mostly illiterate society. He sees that there, at the time, given the long suffering under colonialism, there are few educated people in the country. But educated and literate, these are words that he's using in a Western setting. Of course, they had a complicated linguistic idiom and literature, but that's not Western. And so Gadashanin and Karadzic are really opponents in this regard, and this opposition is going to typify Serbian politics right up until World War I. He is a modernist in the sense that he wants a centralized state. He wants a rational, modern, technological economy to slowly develop out of the farmland, and that this is going to be the root and branch of independence. But he believes in centralization only in the sense that a strong central state alone has the ability to marshal resources. So Karadzic is a folk nationalist. Gadashanin is a modernist in the process of building some concept, some justification of the Yugoslav idea. And you had members of the Radical Party. This is a National Anarchist Party. Those of you who were part of the National Anarchist movement, I've always been very sympathetic to them. The Serbian Radical Party is actually developed explicitly as an anarchist party, but an anarchist party that sees the druga and the commune in the folk tradition as the ultimate authority. That it's a matter of authority and influence, not necessarily power. So the emerging radicals, the national anarchists, they have a strong socialist and agrarian element to them. They are opposed to this concept of Yugoslav centralization. And I think to a great extent, Gadashanin was more an isolated figure because the growing radical party and the thought of Karadzic and then Svetozar Marković is eclipsing some of these people. The radical party is really a creation of Nikola Pašić, who dies in 1926. He becomes one of the main godfathers of the Serbian state. He is a firm nationalist in the sense that a real Serbian political party cannot be a localized phenomenon. It has to be a purely national phenomenon. He believed in a free press. He believed in progressive taxation. He believed in a single, unlimited, unicameral national assembly. And given the nature of the radical party, the state is something that is not to be trusted. And I'm willing to say that Pašić's concept, his ideal, I mean, he's a politician, but he also has an ideal, and that is largely Rousseau's concept of the general will. I mean, he doesn't share in that kind of rationalist, you know, the so-called contract and everything else, but the concept is to create a single folk party, which then will be identical with a single folk-based state. And the state really isn't this kind of coercive apparatus. It's more Rousseauian. It is the sovereign. It is the National Assembly. And for the most part, the community, the local county system, and the extended family are the central elements of any kind of rational society. He is a firm, what we would call a national populist or national anarchist. He believes in a standing army, but only because of these extreme circumstances of Balkan history, and that is very tightly under the control of the unicameral legislature. The Radical Party ends up being an extremely well-organized institution. It's centered around the folk because the other parties, like the Defenders of the Constitution and others, had a tendency to be oligarchic, Western-educated Serbs, and these people in the Radical Party have a tendency to be populist and anarchist in the national sense, to have an army that is tightly under the control of this sort of Rousseauian legislature. And for him, Serbia is the folk. So in that sense, he is similar to Karadzic in terms of this kind of linguistic idea. Pašić developed a concept very close to the national populist idea that the experience of the peasantry. The experience of the peasants make them, in their natural communal structures, the extended family, the druga, these kind of institutions, had a sort of a linguistic, historical, natural, even an inborn sense of justice. And that makes the peasant commune the ultimate mainstay of the state. And again, to use the word state is a problem. Because Posch's idea, now, practical politics have kind of forced him out of this later on. But his ideal was his creation of a highly decentralized republic with the agrarian county system, or the extended family system, at the core. There is a slow increase in the number of educated Serbs out there. Most of them go into the elitist parties, which are largely isolated in Belgrade. Outside of the Radical Party, the dominant parties in Belgrade are these so-called liberals, so-called conservatives, so-called defenders. These are elitist economic institutions made up of a tiny minority of educated Serbs who are educated abroad, some in France, some in Hungary, some in Austria. But like these movements you had elsewhere, the lack of this kind of aristocracy was the very basis of the Radical Party's populism. The bureaucracy and the assembly takes the place of the older nobility that Serbia no longer has. And if there's one thing that the Radical Party takes as central, it's their hatred of bureaucracy. It is the peasant commune, the druga, the county, this agrarian system based on the constitution of the Serbian man, the constitution of the Serbian peasant, the Orthodox Church, the agrarian life, their experience under Ottoman control. These people had developed a very strong, very keen sense of justice, and that their approach to law and tradition is very informal, and yet more people trusted the local courts than any court developed by the Ottomans or these elite Greeks or these elite Serbs in Belgrade. Now, one of the ideological leaders of the Radical Party dies, a young man, in 1875, and he is Svetozar Marković. I've been reading Marković for a very long time. He is a secular man, but from a political point of view, I find him one of the most interesting political philosophers of the Balkans. He is one of the founders of the Radical Party, and he is both a National Socialist and a National Anarchist, and he sees the extended agrarian family as the very cell of this kind of agrarian socialism. The land belongs to all who work it. Labor gives title to the land, not legal ownership. And again, this is something very common within the peasant idea. Marković rejects the concept that there are any of these scientific laws of history. Each nation is different. Each group of people has its own particular linguistic foundation coming from its own historical struggle. People have to be understood in context. We need to make it clear that the socialist movement, 19th century Europe, was as much conservative as it was radical. Most of the socialist movements you come across are agrarian, are Christian, are family-oriented. The kind of Marxist, Jewish, urban, materialist socialism was a tiny minority of urban people, disproportionately Jewish, who looked at the goy out in the countryside as ignorant, and the mentality of Karl Marx and many others proves this. And even you had anarchists like Bakunin, who accused Karl Marx of selling out to the Rothschilds. Bakunin had accused Marx of simply supporting a Jewish nationalist agenda in London, and that part of Bakunin's rhetoric has largely been scoured from his record. The anarchist movement was overwhelmingly Jewish. Bakunin was one of the few who was not, and this tiny little Jewish cult had created this notion of modern anarchism, and Bakunin realized that, and he realized that he wasn't a part of that group because he was not a Jew. And so he had gone after Karl Marx, and even some of the other anarchists that he was working with of receiving money from the Rothschilds and essentially being their golem against the Christian society in Europe. Of course, Bakunin was was an atheist, and yet that's his approach to the situation. Writers like Svetozar Makovich are, when you read their material, agrarian populist. You call them sort of, you know, a national anarchist, a national socialist of one kind or another. That distorts them. But you have to understand that most of the socialism at the time is this kind of agrarian populist idea. The Marxists and later the Bolsheviks were able to completely monopolize that word. And it's really, it's a real problem. I've always called myself a Christian socialist. So did Dostoevsky. So did Solzhenitsyn. But they say that in a very different sense of the word. Markovitch and much of the Radical Party sees labor as the ultimate expression of the social whole. Labor, language, together, create identity. Labor is always social. Even our personal labor is a part of the social whole. Our labor wouldn't mean anything unless we were a part of the natural system of exchange that has always existed at the agrarian level. The bureaucracy is the opposite of justice. Bureaucracy exists for itself. These are unimaginative drones doing the same a job over and over again in offices isolated from the common people. These are the last people who you want to have anything to do with national issues and justice. Because this was not a technocratic society, you can theorize with some rationality a state without bureaucracy. Bureaucracies are necessary because of the grid that technology, overarching technology, places on a society. When you have the extended family farm as self-sufficient, they do not, they're not on a grid. There is no such entity. You can talk about them as a real cell of the broader society. Gadashanin is one of these people who he's almost like the Alexander Hamilton of Serbia. He sees this increasing large, powerful economic industrial state developing over time. But the populist concept, Markovitch and Karadzic and Pasic, these people did not accept that as the destiny of Serbs. Peasants and peasants alone create value in Markovitch's point of view. But as economic modernity continued to move to the countryside, by the mid-1880s already, the peasants are in debt. As economic modernity, industrialization, capitalism, the money economy, wherever it goes, it creates debt. It creates oligarchy. It schemes to take land from peasants, forcing them into the cities. As economic modernity radiates outward from Belgrade, and you also see it among certain Turks and Greeks in the region, debt and the, you know, debt grows, landlessness grows, and this agrarian proletariat continues to grow. Markovitch said that the practice of usury and bureaucracy go together. The essence of modernity is that constant back and forth between usury and the banks, which of course control all economic investment, since you have to go through them to get financing, and the bureaucracy that then provides the structure, the legal structure, by which the banks, those practicing usury, are able to control, take land, and everything else. Markovitch stresses that the local assemblies, small groups of the extended families, the Druga system, should have full control over the local economy, and local autarky is possible, and in fact it did exist at the time. But again, as modernity radiates outward from the cities, peasants go into debt. They are forced to compete with the major banks and major mechanized entities, and of course they lose. Wherever the modern economy goes, it destroys all that are not capable of capturing bureaucratic and legal power. Okay, we're going to take a break here. We are in the middle of discussing the history of Serbian philosophy. We will return here after a few minutes.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are dealing with the history of Serbian philosophy, the 19th and the 20th centuries. And we were in the middle of talking about one of the most interesting young men, the Serbian Radical Party, Svetozar Marković, one of the most interesting philosophers, because he is looking at a Serbia that has a highly cohesive, just, equalitarian county system, a judicial and legislative system in the local areas that is self-sufficient and simply has no poor. There's no rich either. You're members of the extended family, part of the Druga system. You could get kicked out if you simply don't do anything and end up in the cities. But the Serbian countryside is, there's no rich, there's no poor. There is a rational division of labor, a rational division of the various crafts necessary to support an agrarian society. But economic modernity is moving outward from the major cities and immediately puts a tremendous pressure on these formerly autarkic systems. Marković notices this. Marković notices that wherever concentrated capital goes, it centralizes power, it centralizes landholding, it completely monopolizes credit, and the result clearly is oligarchy. Marković, and myself as well, economic modernity is bureaucracy, usury, and debt. And what that really all means is that economic modernity is identical with oligarchy, the rule of money, money being concentrated in a handful of powerful institutions protected by the state. Marković sees this and responds with his sort of a national anarchist approach to the Mir, which is a local community, which is a collection of a handful of the Zdraduga system that has its own court system and has its own legal foundation based on its own tradition. He stresses labor as not just the creation of all value, but it is the expression of the social whole. For him, there are three elements of labor, all of which are social. There is the personal labor of the individual, there's a joint labor of the local extended family, and then there's the national labor of the entire national whole. These three are consistently working together, and Marković's economic idea is that they have to remain balanced. One cannot overtake the other. The one thing about the money economy, Serbia is this, it's almost like a laboratory of this, because you have a very equalitarian, very typical extended family countryside, almost completely untouched by modernity. Slowly, as the 19th century wears on, modernity begins to move in with greater and greater arrogance. So here you have almost a laboratory-like experiment. You see precisely how these two entities work each other out, the traditional peasant organization and economic modernity. And it is the same everywhere. It is landlessness, it is debt, it is a centralization of political and financial power wherever it goes. Wherever modernity goes, it removes peasants from the land, it puts them into debt, it favors only the most powerful institutions which have a monopoly in credit, and therefore the smaller farmsteads end up going into foreclosure. They are forced to spend money to keep up, and the centralized institutions favor other centralized institutions. They are parasitic. And this is people like Pasić and Marković, they look at this. This 19th century Serbian philosophy is based on the concept that the folk state, when it comes in contact with modernity, modernity will always win, and it'll win because it centralizes power, it forces others off the land, and creates a tightly oligarchic system, and there is no exceptions to this. given the history of the Balkans in this period of time. Okay, now there's two Serbian Orthodox writers, both of whom have been canonized, both of whom don't get read an awful lot, oddly enough. This is Justin Popovic, who dies in 1979, and the slightly more famous Nikolai Vamilovic, who dies in the 1950s. Now, Justin Popovic and Vamilovic are metaphysicians. They both have doctoral degrees in the history of philosophy. Popovic holds that the unity of divine and human natures in Christ is the primary and, in fact, the sole core of Christianity as such. The Chalcedonian concept of two equal natures, human and divine, separate but unified in the single person of Jesus as a man, containing those two essences, that is the end of philosophical discussion. That is it. The issues of Plato and Aristotle and Plotinus, they have found their solution at Chalcedon, at the concept of these two natures coming together. The one and the many, these have been taken care of. Free will, all of this has been solved given this single principle. Popovic says, without this connection, without the connection of the divine and human in Christ, it's available to anyone who believes, as the church teaches, your life is meaningless. Your life is a random set of events, almost all of which you have absolutely no control over. And then you simply work, you make somebody else rich, and then eventually you die. And once you retire, most people simply wait around because they don't have anything else to do. They're not constructive, and they get sick, and they eventually die. The point is, and Dostoevsky and so many others have made this comment over time, without eternal life, your life here is meaningless. Of all the thousands of generations that have come and gone, the overwhelming majority of which no one even remembers, their lives were meaningless in every true sense of that phrase, if you hold that there is no afterlife and everything is just mere matter in motion. If it is mere matter in motion, then it doesn't matter what happens. There is no good, there is no bad, there is simply atoms and the void. No one can take that seriously. No one can actually live as if that's all we are. The very fact that we talk about freedom suggests that we have this principle that can abstract from the material world. Popovich's idea is that not even the materialist concept, but the atheist concept in general, which needn't be materialist, people like Fichte and others who had this, the egocentrism of the ego actually creates what is external to it. Either way, however you want to slice it, it is absurdity. There is simply no justice because everything will be destroyed in a very short period of time. So he sees two principles in the world. He sees orthodoxy, which is based exclusively on that Chalcedonian formula. On the other hand, he sees those who disagree with that he throws all into the same category of the heterodox. What typifies all of those movements, according to Popovic, is that they have fragmented the individual. Because they cannot deal with the relation of human and divine, they end up fragmenting the human person into numerous realms, each with its own function. This is not a good human life. He sees the human person as constantly reaching beyond himself. Every human being who is mentally healthy is always moving beyond himself. He is trying to extend his knowledge and his understanding, never satisfied as an individual. We are always reaching beyond these limits. Now, the concept here is sin. Sin is very formal in Popovic. The sort of behavior that Logos has laid out, the union of God and man, once you break that union, it is by definition sin. Now, let's think of it differently. He has an article called The Mystery of Knowledge. He has two different forms of knowledge, one that precedes faith in things and the other that derives from it. Everything is based on faith. If you believe in the scientific method, you have to believe that your senses, in fact, register what's out there. You have to believe that the scientific establishment is, generally speaking, right about things. You have to believe that this is the primary way of knowledge, and things like mystical communion or a communion among individuals or idealism or anything else, that is false. Popovich sees the lowest form of knowledge as this kind of experimental positivist science. It's always changing. And the whole concept of positivism has not fulfilled its promise. For many centuries, this kind of experimental point of view has dominated in all of the advanced countries of the world, and yet there is no more certainty now than there was 100 years ago. With all of the development of the methods of social science, there is no diminution of controversy, even over fundamental issues, as there were 100 years ago. Fact is, the positivist mentality, I'd say over the last 80, 90 years, promised that this experimental method will solve these basic problems. And not only has it not solved them, but has added a huge amount. That the simple concept of scientific experimentation, the building this Baconian positivist idea, has not solved anything. There are no fewer major problems in epistemology now than there were 100 years ago. When you start talking about the centrality of positivist science, you're already making a radical statement based on faith that all we could know out there is based on this positivist idea. Even on the concept of evolution, Popovich says that man is not free. If you believe in this point of view, man is therefore the plaything of these evolutionary forces. If everything is about survival, then we are inherently base, caring only about our ego. Free will is an illusion. A reason is a slave to the survival instinct. Reason is not autonomous. The strong should dominate the weak. Human rights, in even a minimal sense, if you hold to the doctrine of evolution, nothing in that realm makes any sense. If you hold to the doctrine of evolution, you have to hold that our essential egocentrism is base and about surviving at the expense of everything else. Free will is an illusion, and our reason and logic is therefore a slave of this principle, this idea of survival and domination. Popovich is talking about this concept of positivist science and what it leads to if you actually take it seriously. But all of these questions rely on an extrasensory, extra-scientific idea. The nature of positivism, the inductionist, allegedly objective approach to experiment, all of these assume that this scientific knowledge is the best, is the highest, is the most secure, and in fact, according to Popovich, the opposite is true. We experience nature as unfree, and yet at the same time we also experience something that is not material, and that is consciousness and free will. Therefore, it points beyond the natural order to the foundations of the natural order, which is identical to the idea of logos, that single pre-natural or preternatural sense of lawfulness and regularity. This is the origin and final end of all law and science. Now, I'm cramming a whole lot of information into a short period of time, but that's this conception. The Popovich's idea of science, that it always has to go beyond the basic experimental structure that everyone thinks is what science is. And it has to assume a whole bunch about the nature of what they're studying before you can then say that what these people come up with is in fact true. But even when you approach this kind of positivist mentality, there's just as many controversies about the method as there were before the method came into existence. Now, we're going to end with Nikolai Vamilovich. He's written a lot. He is probably the best-known Serb in the philosophical sciences. He is a theologian as well as a metaphysician. And we're just going to concentrate one piece that he wrote, The New Ideal in Education. He sees modernity as the creation of the most powerful classes. He sees these powerful people as redefining the concept of nature. It is not the creation of God. It is this dead, random set of objects that then can have meaning given to it by this elite. It is not something that is naturally harmonious, as the Christian point of view is. that it contains the spiritual core, as a Christian point of view is. It is simply dead matter in motion without purpose and without any kind of order unless we, the elite of society, give it. That is the titanic notion, the idea of the Titan replacing God and then having human force, which is the essence of the Titan, being the only source of meaning and knowledge. Materialism makes no sense. It eliminates reason. Materialism eliminates consciousness. Nothing makes any sense. Random interaction cannot be associated with any kind of lawfulness. It is the strong and the strong alone who decide what truth is. They decide what justice is because you've already admitted that it does not exist in nature. It does not even exist in humanity. The only option left is that it is created and imposed on the society. The problem is this. If you focus your attention on the individual and then admit that individuals are going to pursue their own self-interest, then once the oligarchy takes over and dominates, you now have no basis to criticize them because they, just like you, were pursuing their own interests. The fact that they were successful and you were not has no moral significance. Vemilovich holds that this kind of individualism is a logical and epistemological contradiction. It's absurd since the individual does not exist. The individual is absolutely dependent on language, education, the state, legal code, the fields of skill, whether it be education or law or anything like that. All of this predates the individual. The individual becomes an individual only because he is encased in all of these institutions. He calls it panhumanism, this new ideal that ultimately it is the elite that give meaning to the natural world, not the other way around. That the individualist idea develops after the capitalist idea and therefore justifies the monopoly of power in a tiny handful of people. Not to mention the simple fact that materialist science cannot conceive of the individual. To take one hunk of matter and separate it from another hunk of matter is arbitrary. There might be certain things that appeal to you why you should separate one chunk from another, but that's only of subjective importance. So even the concept of the individual makes no sense. The fact that consciousness developed this way does not have any scientific importance, doesn't even have any moral importance. Materialism is a single large mechanism of motion. To tease out an individual is absurd. You can't tease out one little piece of a big machine. The machine breaks down. Everything has to be working. The machine has to function. But that's all it is. Random interaction based just on the most base laws of material causation. So the idea that both materialism and individualism, they ultimately make no sense. Just like Popovich, he's talking about evolution, that ultimately if survival and that survival drive is what has ultimately created everything in the world, good, bad, or indifferent, then you must admit that reason is a product of this drive and hence could never be autonomous. So when the secular mind talks about reason as if it's some sort of a totem that we're to bow to, they cannot make any sense out of reason. If you hold that all of this is a matter of competition, competition for scarce resources for the sake of progeny, survival, reason is then a total slave to the passions. The passions are far more immediate and of far greater scientific import than reason. Reason may be able to conceptualize certain things, but it is a product of the survival drive. The survival drive is superior to the rational understanding of it. But Popovich and Vemilovich end up saying the same thing about the nature of this panhumanist approach to science. If a secular person does not believe in the materialist conception of the world, then they have to develop a theory of where spirit came from. That matter somehow contains spirit implicitly, because if it didn't, then there is no way to account for the existence of spirit. Spirit, in this case, I'm referring specifically to free will, the ideas and concepts that we develop and that we can use as causes for our action. That's what I mean specifically. But still, that has to be accounted for. Unless, of course, you hold the view that the spirit is something concocted by the human for the sake of survival, that it has in and of itself some survival value, and that is able to create abstract designs and things like that, and to create technology, and yet then you still are in the same position. Reason then is nothing more than a tool that helps you with very specific survival things. You cannot then take it and universalize it. The mentality of Kant or even the will to power doesn't make any sense within this schema. And both Popovich and Vamilovich have taken this very Western, very British, very bourgeois idea of material evolution and really tease out the absurdities, especially when it comes to what happens to reason and certainly the total destruction of any sense of the individual that this creates. The idea of the individual is both a product of the Enlightenment, but also it makes sense of and justifies the existence of oligarchy. Now, in this talk, I know I've crammed so much into a very short period of time. There is so much material here. Vamilovich, when he talks about technology, I mean, of course, he's not opposed to technology in general, but he uses two archetypes, two Platonic forms of two different types of technology. On the one hand, the Ark of Noah, and on the other hand, the Tower of Babel. Both are extremely sophisticated, as we know from the pyramids, for example, of mentally sophisticated things. The Ark is clearly a very sophisticated piece of work. Both are technological, both use reason, both use quantitative measurement, etc., and yet two very different purposes, two very different points of view. On the one hand, the Ark was for the sake of the protection of the righteous. On the other hand, the Tower of Babel was the vehicle of the arrogant and powerful to attempt to replace God. Nikolai Vamilovich, I think, errs when he says the Temple of Solomon is an example of good technology, because ultimately Solomon was heavily influenced by the pagans in how it was to be completed, and of course using forced labor. Actually, you know, the Temple of Solomon is a Kabbalistic and Masonic icon, and Vamilovich errs in using it as an example of good technology. In fact, ultimately Solomon's temple ends up being no different than the Tower of Babel, at least as far as the intentions of its creators were concerned. You have two concepts here. And these two men, you have the idea of science on the one hand as being the study of spirit or the unchanging essences in things, or it is an alchemical recreation of nature that does not believe in any kind of immaterial essence but seeks to create it of their own accord. Vamilovich, and one way I think we could end this here is the unity of so much of what the agrarian populists were saying in the 19th century and what these two Orthodox saints are saying in the 20th century is that there are two approaches here. Either technology works with nature for the sake of supporting the normal, natural functions of human life, or it's to replace nature because the elite want authority very tightly centralized. And in many ways, it's not just Vamilovich and Popovich, who I here just went through very rapidly. But I think it's pretty clear how this is connected with the national anarchist and populist idea of people like Markovitch and Passage, that there are always two approaches to how we view the natural world. The view that puts logos at the center of everything. Logos being the material essence, the entire blueprint, so to speak, that holds the entire cosmological entity together, that becomes the purpose of scientific investigation. Or the opposite, the idea that there is no spiritual blueprint, and in fact much of what we call laws are random interaction, but it never ends there. Nature is then alchemically, radically reordered, and then made to serve the system. And we see how that centralization of credit, you need to finance this stuff, of machinery, the so-called grid, and what it did in the peasant world, wherever it was imposed. This is about oligarchy. This is about power. It could be the Egyptian pyramids, the golden image in the Plain of Dura in the Book of Daniel, of Solomon's Temple, of Tower of Babel. These are icons of the system, because not only much of this was forced labor and had a centralized state and the use of technology, the point was to recreate nature into the image of the elite. On the other hand, whether it be the Ark of Noah, the Ark of the Covenant prior to the construction of the temple, it's a very different story. It is not replacing nature. It is almost doing homage to nature and using it for the sake of local needs, of actual local physical and social requirements, not the complete reorientation of the planet to justify the oligarchy of credit and technology and power. And so I'm willing to say that everyone who I very rapidly talked about in this hour has that one concept, with the exception of Gadashanin, who was probably the modernist person that we dealt with. But as a matter of course, this 19th and 20th century Serbian philosophical idea worries greatly about what economic and technological modernity does to the people who have no concept of it. And in Serbia, it was, wherever it went, the complete destruction of the agrarian life, a massive increase in debt, the loss of land, the loss of power, and the tight centralization of anything and everything that favored only its own equally centralized corporate manifestations of power. The result is that the folk people who were at the very center of this kind of national rebirth now were driven off the land in massive debt, and they were created as proletarians and sent to the cities, and they ended up working in the factories and were to be slaughtered in World War One and World War Two anyway. But that's the tragedy, and yet this also is a blueprint for serious intellectual reconstruction. So I thank you guys for listening. I know I just ran roughshod here. I mean, this is, you know, I crammed so much information in an hour. But if you want me to expand on this, anything here, simply email me. And I'd appreciate any of your financial donations. You know how much I hate talking about money. But it's something that, for my family and I, is a painful and dehumanizing necessity. And I thank you all, and I appreciate you for listening. And I ask of your assistance, as always, and I thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at reasonradionetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.